Okay, PCW News. Time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Well, this is the kind of day when everyone wants to talk to the weatherman to find out what's going on. We're lucky we have Nate Larson from ABC4 on the line. Nate, what have we seen so far, and what are we likely to see coming up?
You know, it's been a pretty decent storm system as far as we've had really healthy moisture amounts across some of the Wasatch Front as far as rain goes. Haven't quite seen the snow pile up in the mountains just yet, as we're hoping, but the general forecast, again, above Park City levels for some of the mountain areas, Wasatch Range, south of I-80, still has a winter storm warning for anywhere from 8 to 16 inches. We've seen about 4 and 5 inches reported at some of the higher elevations. It looks like Park City has had a little bit of snow from some of the web cameras that I can see. Not a whole lot. There's still a chance for snow showers into the early afternoon. Might see another inch or so accumulate. But with temperatures warming to the low 40s, likely won't see it amount to much. Hopefully the roadways continue to stay clear. They likely will with some of the sun poking through the cloud cover. So snow showers today, a lot of the moisture clears out into the afternoon. Should see a pretty sunny weekend in store. A lot of the moisture is going to stay to the southeast of us. So mostly sunshine now in store for Saturday. Might see a stray shower pop up in the morning hours, but temperatures are going to be cold, just 30 degrees as you step outside Saturday morning. Highs near 53. 33 into Sunday with a high of mid-50s into next week, and then high pressure builds back in, so we'll continue to warm back up above average conditions with mid-60s expected through Tuesday, Wednesday, and even Thursday next week. Overnight lows hovering near 40 degrees. Heber looking at temperatures near 49 today. Again, a bit of a wintry mix. We've mainly seen rain showers across Heber Valley this morning, so expecting a little bit more moisture through early afternoon as well before things taper off. Mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies into Saturday. Temperatures after a chilly overnight in the mid to upper 20s, about 60 degrees for the high. Should see similar temperatures on Sunday. And then with that high pressure building in, we'll see temperatures climb to the low 70s through midweek next week. Overnight lows hovering near freezing with ample sunshine. Looks like we could see another storm next weekend.
So, Nate, as I was driving in this morning, there was some blowing snow, and it was a little slick. What kind of daytime temperatures are we likely to see, and are we likely to see some continued sort of minor slickness on the roads?
You know, with the tricky part is with temperatures hovering right around freezing, which is where temperatures are right now. So it's cold enough to actually freeze on the surface. But as we're driving over the surfaces, the tires are a little warmer, end up melting whatever snow or slush might be on there, and it could quickly refreeze. As temperatures, though, are going to rebound into the mid to upper 30s this morning, I suspect roadways really shouldn't be too slick, even with some of the snow coming down, unless we get some real heavy snow showers that start to accumulate with, you know, 1 or 2 inches per hour, then we would start to see some impacts to some of the roads. I mean, this is a good, I guess, reminder on winter driving habits, slowing down, you know, giving yourself plenty of distance between other vehicles in front of you, and just be mindful that there could be some slick spots out there.
I was reminded of that, and I was wishing I already had my snow tires. Thanks, Nate.
Yeah, I bet. You bet.
Coming up, Parker Malatesta had a chance to speak with Nancy Keats. She's the Wall Street Journal reporter that recently filed a story about Park City real estate. Then I'll be joined in the studio by Park City High School football coach Josh Monsinga. We're going to finish our hour with Park City librarian Adrian Juarez about the upcoming Wasatch Back Book Festival. We have a timely story. The Utah Department of Transportation is ramping up weather-related tire inspections in the Cottonwood Canyons this winter. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the goal is to increase safety and reduce traffic.
Flashing lights in canyons indicate when the traction law is in effect. It requires vehicles to have traction devices like tire chains, tire cables, or snow socks, or snow-rated tires. UDOT Roadway Operations Manager Jake Brown says the law helps people get through canyons safely.
If your vehicle is equipped properly, you'll be able to navigate the snow and the ice better than if you were to have bald tires. The other thing is to keep people moving through the canyon and to keep going and not stalling out and leaving those people exposed in those type of avalanche areas.
Police will be stationed at various checkpoints to ensure vehicles are complying with the law. The Little Cottonwood Canyon checkpoint is at the gate buttress near mile marker 5. The Big Cottonwood Canyon checkpoint is at the chain-up area just past the water plant and Canyon Estate Drive gates. A map of the checkpoints is available at kpcw.org. UDOT is partnering with the Cottonwood Heights Police Department for enforcement at the mouth of Big Cottonwood Canyon and the Sandy City Police Department for enforcement at Little Cottonwood Canyon. The Sully County Sheriff's Office will assist with vehicles throughout both canyons. Brown says UDOT also offers the Cottonwood Canyon Sticker Program to make the inspection process easier. The free program allows drivers to have their vehicles pre-inspected for compliance with the traction law. If in compliance, the driver will get a sticker for their windshield, allowing them to bypass inspection checkpoints. Brown says the traction law helps get drivers to resorts in the Cottonwood Canyons faster.
You don't have people that have the wrong tires or no traction devices spun out and stuck. And so traffic proceeds faster up the canyon when the vehicle is equipped correctly.
The increased enforcement is possible due to additional funding provided by the Utah legislature through HB 488, which was passed earlier this year. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, Park City Transit saw more riders this spring and summer and during special events. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has this.
Ridership on Park City Transit buses increased 6% during the spring and summer this year as compared with 2023 data. The spring and summer seasons for the transit department span from April 1st to September 30th. Park City buses served more than 70,000 people during special events this year, including the Kimball Arts Festival and 4th of July parade. That marks a 12% increase in ridership compared to special events in 2023. According to a staff report, city officials believe there is not one particular reason for the ridership increase. During the same time period, Park City Transit buses reported an on-time performance rate of 91%. A bus is considered on time if it departs no later than 5 minutes from a scheduled service time. Heading into this winter, Park City Transit is changing the name of several buses that service the Richardson Flat Park and Ride. Routes are getting simpler names to represent their final destinations. They include the Old Town Express, Park City Mountain Express, and Deer Valley Express. More details about service times can be found at kpcw.org. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
The best cross-country skiers in the U.S. gathered in Park City Wednesday to mark the beginning of the World Cup season. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that Team USA's star is rising on the Nordic circuit.
It's sometimes called the toughest sport in the world, but in America, cross-country skiing doesn't draw the same viewership as ski racing or freestyle. After an historic Minneapolis World Cup this February, the team's chief of sport, Anouk Patty, sees that changing.
It's the first time an American has won a cross-country event in 43 years, and he did it on home soil.
That first American man to win in four decades is Gus Schumacher, one of the sport's rising stars. He was part of a four-athlete panel at the sport's Park City training facility Tuesday, which also featured two legendary skiers on the women's side, Olympians Jesse Diggins and Park City native Rosie Brennan. Brennan commented on the camaraderie among teammates who, when traveling to compete with native Nordic athletes, have historically been underdogs.
It's 4 months of being together in hotel rooms and apartments and whatnot, without your family, without your best friends, it's more than just being a teammate at the race course. It's being a teammate 24/7. And so it's a different meaning for our team.
Brennan represented the U.S. in Pyeongchang and Beijing, and after a decade on the national team, has over 200 World Cup starts, 12 podiums, and 2 victories. And then there's Diggins, the winningest American in cross-country skiing ever.
Usually we do define success as gold medals and Olympics and the really shiny pieces of hardware. But for me, that's not really the thing that you can ultimately control. You can actually control who you are as a teammate, how you show up for your team, and what you give back to the sport.
And the four pros had an audience of youngsters, still in their boots from roller ski practice. Another rising star on the men's side, Ben Ogden, was asked about his so-called Benny Shuffle, where he shuffles up a hill really fast. Here's press officer Leanne Bentley.
How do you go so fast? And what can you give to these little kids who maybe want to be you when they grow up?
Good question. A tricky one to answer, I guess, but I try really, really hard. That usually helps.
U.S. Ski and Snowboard CEO Sophie Goldschmidt says last winter was the national cross-country team's best season and hopes to keep the momentum. Team USA's cross-country events will be streamed online at skiandsnowboard.live. The season begins November 29th with the men's and women's 10K Classic in Ruka, Finland. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Recently, the Wall Street Journal published an article with the rather eye-catching headline, "Home Prices Exploded in Park City. These Towns Are Taking Advantage." KPCW's Parker Malatesta got a chance to sit down and speak with the journalist Nancy Keats about the story. Here's his report.
I am KPCW's Parker Malatesta. You're listening to the local news hour. On the phone with me now, I've got Nancy Keats. She's a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. How's it going, Nancy?
Hi, it's going pretty well. I wish I was in Park City, but otherwise it's going well.
Nancy, you recently published a story in the journal's real estate section called Home Prices Exploded in Park City. These towns are taking advantage. And it really paints a full picture for kind of what has gone on in the real estate market in the Wasatch Back. You know, if you kind of had to sum it up, I mean, what was your kind of primary takeaway after writing this article?
Well, I think it's interesting how I came to this article. So I've written a few stories on towns in Idaho, towns called Driggs and Victor. They're in northeast Idaho near Grand Targhee Ski Resort. And there, during those stories, I discovered this really strong expat community from Park City. So a bunch of people who had moved to Idaho after living for decades in Park City because they thought Park City was ruined. You know, too much development and traffic and home prices out of control. One guy I interviewed, I remember clearly, told me how he used to sit at his favorite cafe in Park City and stare up the mountain. And then it became he would sit at his favorite cafe and stare up at construction cranes. And, you know, most of these people were like hardcore backcountry skiers and climbers, the kind of people who would move to Idaho. But I was curious to see if it was affecting maybe less extreme people. And so I started making some calls to real estate agents and looking at the statistics and home prices. And it seemed pretty clear that the changes in Park City were pretty extreme. You know, every mountain resort town across the country saw a surge of buyers and increased prices because of COVID, you know, when people wanted to get out of big cities and they could work from home. And that in terms of, you know, a sort of coupled with climate change and how it's making life in places like Florida increasingly untenable, it's a perfect storm for ski towns that's led to more development and higher prices. You know, Snowmass, Glenwood Springs, outside Aspen, that kind of thing. But Park City stood out to me in my reporting because of the sheer escalation of its prices. I mean, the average home price for you guys grew 35% between 2022 and 2023. And other towns grew, but not so much. Like maybe it was 9.4% in Vail and Beaver Creek and 3.2% in Aspen. I mean, one issue is that the price point in Park City was lower than, you know, Vail and Aspen. So people saw it as maybe more affordable, you know, like 1.5 million instead of 3 to 11 million. But that really stood out to me.
Yeah. And so that reporting in Idaho, is that what kind of led you to want to do this story?
It is, because I saw the same thing happening in Idaho. So these people moved, a lot of them from Park City, to Driggs and Victor, which are these adorable small towns near skiing. And now they're complaining because prices have gotten so high in Jackson Hole that people are moving from Wyoming, which is right over the pass, into their towns and crowding them out. Home prices have gone up. So I thought it's probably something, you know, very similar happening around Park City. So that's kind of how I started out on this story.
Yeah, and again, those people that you spoke with that left Park City, that was, you know, they said primarily driven just by overdevelopment and kind of the loss of the character of town.
Yeah, I think just crowding in general. So traffic, you know, the slopes were getting more crowded, I think, since Vail bought it. You know, it's part of these passes, so there's more people. But also a change in just the feeling of the town. They wanted something maybe less elite.
Yeah. Well, you know, sorry to take a step back, Nancy. Could you just, you know, tell us a bit about your beat and just, you know, what you kind of routinely cover at the Journal?
Yeah. So I've been a reporter at the Journal for 30 years, if you can believe
Very
that.
Cool.
I started at Associated Press Dow Jones, called AP Dow Jones, in Johannesburg, South Africa. And I moved to Washington. I covered international trade there. And then I became a travel reporter. Now I'm based in Portland, and I cover residential real estate, architecture, and design around the country and how those things kind of intersect. But because it's the Wall Street Journal and because my section is called Mansion, I tend to focus on the higher end. And so I do cover a lot of, you know, large homes and the architecture. But I've also noticed in doing these stories, you know, the impact on the towns, you know, these homes have and the people who are moving in have.
Yeah, and so, you know, to dive into the story, you know, Park City's in the headline, but, arguably the story's more so about kind of Heber City and Midway and Camas and these other areas that are seeing this immense growth, you know, due to people that maybe aren't as attracted to living in Park City for a variety of reasons, obviously given cost and crowding, as you mentioned. So, you know, you talked to a few home buyers that ended up, you know, finding places in Midway and Heber and Camas, as I mentioned. When you talk to them, I mean, what were the main variables circling their mind?
Right. So I think it's the same thing for everyone looking at the whole area, maybe, you know, people moving in, which is that Park City it's so close to the airport in Salt Lake City, so easy to get to, which is unusual for ski resorts. And that's definitely a main attraction. And then also the variety of skiing, you know, you have three options, and now Deer Valley East or, you know, Mayflower, whatever you want to call it, is coming. So it seems like also a lot of people had heard of Park City, maybe because of Sundance. So people from like places like New York and Dallas and LA who may not know anything in Montana have heard of Park City. I think, and so the people who I interviewed, they wanted that, but they also wanted beautiful land and space. And I think that's another thing that Park City, the area, you know, the towns around it, have, which a lot of ski resorts don't have anymore, which is available, beautiful land. But as I say in the story, I think that's changing, because not only are these individual homeowners buying places in Heber and Midway and, you know, Camas, but it's also these developments are popping up, these enormous gated luxury golf developments. And I think that's having a huge impact in the area.
Yeah, I did want to touch on those luxury developments here shortly, but just to, you know, a lot of realtors around here, ever since East Village, that expansion was announced, you know, you've heard a lot of the, oh, Heber and Midway are now ski towns now. But it sounds like from your reporting, that's kind of the viewpoint of some of those new homeowners in the Heber Valley. They see skiing, even though they're not in Park City, they feel just as proximate to skiing.
Yes, for sure. And the other thing, I mean, there seems to be two things going on. You know better than I do, but two things going on in Heber, for example, at once. There's like a lot of new tract housing for maybe people under the $1 million price point. But then there's these gated golf developments, which are attracting golfers, but also people who want to ski because they have shuttles to these ski areas. And every single person I interviewed who has recently bought there mentioned the East Village and the expansion and how it's going to make getting to the slopes so much faster for them and less traffic, which I know I'm a little bit wary about that because I can imagine all these people now going there and the traffic will be terrible. But that was definitely a motivation, was skiing. And I don't know, it might be going too far to say that Heber is a ski town, but I think maybe more so than it used to be.
Yeah, definitely. And so, you know, you mentioned several of these luxury developments, Red Ledges, Toohey. I think a lot of our listeners are aware of these projects that are kind of dot around our communities. Are you seeing a lot of growth in this area and other ski towns? I mean, what do you see? Is it really just the heavy on amenities that appears to be the main draw?
Well, it's interesting because I think what's different, like I said, with these other ski resort towns, there's not that much land available around them, whereas there is a lot around Park City. And I think so what's happening is kind of a conjunction with the trend of golf, because golf is booming right now. Mm-hmm. All people are just buying at golf resorts. And, you know, that's all over the country, but it just happens to be right next to Park City because you get both golf and skiing. You know, I've been a reporter long enough to see the booms and busts of golf developments. So I don't know if that's a good investment or not, but right now it is. And I think that's maybe a difference between, you know, Park City area and other ski resorts. I mean, you can't build a golf resort in Jackson Hole. There's just no land available.
Yeah. And, you know, as you mentioned in your story, the kind of this new trend of kind of buyers looking more outside Park City, you know, it has resulted in a price increase. You know, Heber home prices have more than doubled since pre-pandemic. Camas in Summit County is kind of approaching that point too, not double, but close.
What I've noticed is that there's definitely, you know, during the pandemic, there was a huge influx of home buyers and prices, you know, in sort of recreation, outdoor-friendly areas. But I think that is fading somewhat. But what's not fading is this market, the fact that there's so little available and prices are still high because mortgage rates are high. And the other thing that's not changing is this acceleration in wealth in the United States. So there's just, I see this all over the country. People own multiple homes. You know, I'm not just saying one vacation home, like three or four homes, because they see real estate as kind of as an essential element to diversify their investment portfolio. So why not have real estate somewhere that's beautiful and outdoor friendly? And so that's something that I haven't seen changing. And that also seems to be pushing prices up, because a lot of these houses just sit empty where, you know, so people, they're not for sale.
Yeah. And I did want to, you know, I know one of the homeowners that you interviewed just kind of talked about the rural nature of Midway. Just kind of, what did those Heber homebuyers have to say just in regards to the rural nature of things?
Yeah, I mean, that was a huge attraction to them, the rural nature. I think they would use the word cute. Mm-hmm. I think it's just having space and land, and I think that's harder and harder as the country, as development continues to push those prices further and further out, and I've seen that everywhere around the country.
Yeah, and you, as you said, the desire for recreation-friendly outdoor spaces remains. And you also said, just compared to other ski towns, that Park City just, on a, you know, outside of it, just kind of has more space to develop. But when you're looking at other high-end markets and just reporting around the country, I mean, in general, what stands out to you about what's going on here in Park City?
I think what stands out to me is, first of all, it's just so close to a major airport. I mean, that's something most of these resorts are not. They're really hard to get to. Like, for example, in Oregon, if I want to go skiing, I have to put chains on my car, if you can imagine that. But so I think that's a huge issue. I think another issue is that it seems to have attracted a lot of investors. So people think it's a good investment, or thought it was, actually, because prices were lower for some reason. And, you know, it was close to the airport and there was a lot of open land. So I think that's also what makes it stand out. You know, I think maybe the weather is great and the skiing is great. And so those are the snow, I guess, is amazing. That's what people say. So those things make it stand out. I think it had really good marketing with the Sundance Festival. I think people looked at it as sort of this beautiful place they'd see on Page Six coverage of the celebrities walking around town. You know, and I think maybe just the lack of development in Heber and Midway up to this point is something that stands out as well.
Yeah, and you know, just to zoom out further, you know, covering the kind of luxury real estate market, as you mentioned, just around the country, I mean, are there any particular trends you're starting to see kind of emerge?
Well, I mean, we report on them all the time. Like, we just had a story saying Florida's over, everyone's leaving Florida. Mm-hmm. I think climate change is definitely impacting where people are looking.
Yeah.
So people are leaving Florida. Maybe people see Utah as, I know there's like a water issue, but maybe they see that as sort of immune from wildfires and earthquakes and hurricanes. I think that's impacting where people are looking. I think there's been, you know, the climate change issue with skiing is kind of interesting, because I think there was a lot of pushback on Deer Valley East Village because it's so low and like, how would snow stay there? But, and so I did actually a story a couple years ago about snow and ski resorts and climate change and how they're going to handle that. I think people are looking at all of those factors.
Yeah, no, certainly an open question on how much skiing remains in the years ahead. But those are kind of all the main things I wanted to hit on, Nancy. Are there any other points you wanted to make?
I guess I wanted to say that it's kind of a, you know, all those skiers and climbers who I met when I was in Driggs and Victor, who are now complaining about, who were complaining about Park City, they're now complaining about what's happening in Idaho. So I think that it's just something that it's going to continue as we continue to develop as a country. And, you know, it's just, there's less and less remote space. More of it is owned by people, and that's just a factor that I've noticed.
Yeah, you're going to have to go to really rural Montana or Wyoming to get that rural nature.
Or be like a billionaire and buy up, right. You know, like this one guy in Idaho has bought, I don't know, 40, 50 properties. He now owns a vast amount of space and he's putting in guard gates and he has his helicopter. That's a trend that I see that I don't really like very much.
That's certainly one way to do it.
Yeah.
Well, Nancy, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us and just share details on your reporting. I know it was well read in town and just nice to get some more details.
Great. Thank you so much.
We've been speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Nancy Keats, who recently published the story, Home Prices Exploded in Park City. These towns are taking advantage. We'll link it online if you want to read it.
The Park City Miners football team wrapped up a successful regular season Wednesday night with a thrilling overtime win over the Springville Red Devils. Here to recap the season and to talk about the upcoming playoffs is head coach Josh Monsinga. Good morning, Josh. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Josh, that 9-1 record's pretty impressive. Were you surprised at what your team has been able to accomplish so far?
Not really. I had high expectations for this team. And, you know, honestly, I feel like we could have gotten all of those taken care of. I feel like we shouldn't have dropped the one to Stansbury, but I think you're going to feel that every single year, no matter what. I feel like you should win them all. But great team in Stansbury, tough fought game, kind of playing for the region right there. That one's going to be hard to swallow, but I'm so proud of our guys. What a season.
So what happened in the Stansbury game? What do you think went wrong?
A couple of factors. They have a great defense. Kind of gave us some fits on offense. We lost our starting running back for part of the game. He tried to come in back at the end of the game, put us on his back a little bit and get us in. And we had three chances inside the 10. We should have had 21 points, more than enough to win that game. Our defense played their hearts out. And I got to give credit to Stansbury. They played a really hard-fought game. Very well-coached team. Made it difficult all night. But it's one of those games where it's a bit of a rivalry. And it doesn't matter who's good or not. It's going to be a hard-fought game. Playing down there, it was a lot of factors, but mostly we just missed our opportunities.
Do your players react to the difference between, was playing on grass a factor in their minds?
You know, in our minds, somehow it always seems to be. It's kind of crazy. It's like, we don't even have a grass field to go find to try and get on to show them that you're okay. You won't die and you can still run. It'll be fine. Did a couple guys slip here and there? Sure. Do they have to play on the same field, Stansbury? Yes. So that's not an excuse. But yeah, it does get in a couple guys' minds at times. My kicker was kind of freaking out at the beginning. Like, I don't know if I can do this. And then the next thing you know, he's blasting it through the end zone like normal. I'm like, oh, you're fine. He goes, yeah, I am.
Okay, so you talked about how you had high expectations for the team. Were there any players that surprised you with their growth and accomplishment this year?
You know, it's hard to say just one. I mean, we grew a lot. We had a big senior class last year, which it seems like kind of happens every year. So you're always got a bunch of guys looking to step in and step up. And I felt like we had a lot of growth on our D-line this year, which was important because we lost everybody. So everybody stepping in on that D-line has really just kind of stepped in and done a great job. Tyler DeMarco has really stepped up and just kind of sealed that and been kind of that big leader on that front and done a good job. And then on the offensive side, kind of had a new position put in with a tight end. And we've had a couple tight ends step up that have done just a great job of rotating. And Charlie Cusimano and Luke Castelli and just blocking their souls out, knowing they're not going to get every ball every time. And they're kind of more of a receiver look, but they're like, I'll block whoever shows up. I mean, I got to give a lot of credit to those guys that, you know, being in the trenches, that's where it's won. And they did a lot of hard work this year. I'm really proud of those guys.
So, as we head into the playoffs, what do you feel you need to work on?
Oh, you know, there's always a lot you want to work on. I think consistency at times, just making sure that we are mentally focused and prepared. We know our assignments. We're not making little mistakes that can, in a big game, cost you big time. We had a couple of those moments on Friday night where it was like just one mental go the wrong way, and that could have been the big deal in the game. You know, they had a couple of those too, thankfully, so it kind of balanced itself out. But in a playoff game, you can't afford those. You got to know exactly where you're going, what you're doing, what your assignment is. So just making sure we're not trying to do too much. The fundamentals, staying close on those things, and that's kind of what we'll spend. I think we'll have a bye week coming up next week, just working on us, making sure that we are the best we can be going in.
So typically, at the high school level, you don't change much between the regular season and the playoffs, do you?
No. We could try. I mean, I think my mad scientist brain has tried it before, and the problem is you're asking a lot of some young men who, you know, have a million other distractions in life to try and learn something new. We need to get better at what we do. Maybe it's a wrinkle here or there. You know, everybody's doing this to stop this, so if we just try it this way, it'll pop open, but it's not a big change, those kind of things. Just trying to make sure that we are maybe a little bit tricky, but not crazy.
Now, you mentioned that you expect to have a bye. Can you sort of lay out for our audience who may not be all that familiar with it, how do the playoffs work, and why would you have a bye?
Well, we have the mystical, magical RPI that no one has seemed to be able to quite figure out. And Max Preps is an online resource where the schedules are kept. And they have a formula that goes in with your wins are the first and foremost the biggest part of it. Your opponent's wins, then your opponent's opponent's wins. So strength of schedule is a big factor of that. It's not a margin of victory thing, which a lot of people are worried about. That's not a thing at all. Our strength of schedule necessarily wasn't as tough, mostly just because of our region. Outside of Stansbury, it wasn't as challenging as much as we wish it would be. So we try to make the rest of it as challenging as possible. A couple of those teams didn't work out this year either to help our favor. So we just had to make sure we won as many of them as possible, which is why Springville was such a big deal for us. But once you get settled out, they turn it off this last week here, so nobody knows where anybody's at. And they have a big reveal on Saturday morning, and they'll turn it back on, and we'll find out magically where we all finished out. We know where we were a week ago, which was sitting at 6. We're thinking maybe we can move up one. Maybe two, but we'll see what happens. It depends on who did what around us. And now that the formula's turned off, we're all looking at some guru on Twitter and seeing if he can figure out his magical formula. So honestly, nobody knows till Saturday morning.
And would you would expect to have a bye?
I do. With the win, it's the top eight that get a bye.
Right.
I just can't see any scenario where we would fall out of the top eight. I told our guys that.
Okay. So you probably have a bye, and then would you have a home game also?
Yeah, that would give us, if we were to finish fifth, let's say, with what we were thinking, we would have a first game, which would be the second round home, and then you'd be in that 4-5 matchup, so you'd probably be going to the road to play the fourth, unless there was some kind of upset
unless
there.
Unless they lost, right.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you were to finish top four, you get the guaranteed first two, which is what we did last year. We finished four last year. We got the first two at home.
So how many weeks will the playoffs last?
They last for 5 weeks.
5 weeks. Okay, yeah. So you guys, you're hopefully going to be working at this for a while.
Absolutely. we told them, you got no plans for a month. We're going to be busy. We're going to have fun.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you lost a lot of the squad. I mean, one of the things about high school in particular is there's going to be a lot of turnover every year. How much of the squad will you be losing this year?
Oh, it seems like a similar amount. We're in that mid-upper 20s, about the same as last year. And many of them play critical roles again. But that is the nature of the beast. It's high school. We're going to have to, relearn and regrow. And that's why we do a lot of rotating. We do a good job of my staff is amazing, and they're great at developing. And they do a good job of rotating in real game situations with young players when it's appropriate and safe to do so. So a lot of guys get a good experience.
Get some time.
That they're not just starting completely over for like straight from JV, which is a huge jump. So I think that helps us in our growth each year.
And are you seeing, are many of your players getting some interest from college recruiters?
Yeah, we absolutely do. We just, our quarterback actually, as an athlete quarterback, I mean, he's a unique individual who could play tight end, he could play receiver. He, he's tall and can stand in the pocket and throw a rocket ball. He can run the ball. I mean, he can do a lot of different things. He just picked up an offer from Utah Tech the other day, and also has another offer from it was a Division II school, I think. He's picked up a couple there. We have a lot of interest with our tackle, Justin Michaelis. Utah State's been kind of high on him and kind of watching and waiting. And they're notorious for taking a little bit of time. They can be a little bit choosy. But I know he's picked up a ton of interest there. And Weber State's been checking in as well. And we've had a few schools checking in on a few different guys. So we have some interest. It's getting with the recruiting landscape now that's changed a little bit with the transfer portal. High school kids have to wait a little longer than they used to.
So you have to
be more patient. Yeah, and everybody's having a hard time with that. And, I mean, myself included, but I'm kind of maybe just starting to see the writing on the wall that we have to wait a little bit. Like, they're holding spots for transfers, and if you are on the tweener, if you're a tweener, you're on the bubble of size or anything, you might have to wait even longer than you did before, because those are kind of a primary thing or a luxury to have those guys sitting around that are already college ready that so they're grabbing those guys first. So we just got to wait and see how things let roster shake out, and we might pick them up on the second round. So
now, is that stressful? I mean, what role do you as a coach play in that?
As far as me, I mean, a lot of the thing is on the athlete. They have to market themselves. That's where X or Twitter comes in. They need to get after marketing themselves, get their highlights out there, connect with coaches, emails, going to camps. There's a lot of stuff they need to do, and that's really the biggest thing. But for me, I have contacts over the years I've made from our guys that have played at or been recruited by. I'll reach out and ask if they'll get evaluated, and that's about the furthest I can go. They'll trust me that I won't just steer them to someone that's not going to be able to play for them. And if they're good enough, that that'll help. I mean, that's so I can get the door open. But then after
they
that, again,
it's
a relationship between two parties again. And I'm kind of a broker sometimes, if you want to look at it that way. And I just trying to make sure I have a good enough reputation that I've never led somebody astray or, you know, oversold someone.
Okay. Well, Josh, good luck in the playoffs. Anything else you want to touch on before we go?
No, go Miners.
Go Miners. We'll be right back after this. Well, the Park City Library is joining with the Summit County Library, Wasatch County Library, to sponsor the Wasatch Back Book Festival. Here to talk about it is Park City Librarian Adrian Herrick-Juarez. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Roger. It's great to be here with you.
Thanks for being here on this snowy Friday morning. So, Adrian, how does this fit into the overall Utah Humanities Book Festival? Can you give us some context for what's going on here?
I'll be happy to. Utah Humanities Book Festival has been going across the state for the last 17 years. However, this year, they are doing something new, which is regional book festivals. So if somebody wanted to come to a particular region and try and get in all the activities going on in that area, they could possibly do it. So this is a new approach this year.
So there are other sort of areas within the region that are doing similar festivals that you could
use? Yep. They've got Salt Lake going. They've got Southern Utah. And they each have a week-long event
different
calendar.
Weeks.
Different weeks throughout the month of October.
Okay. So, obviously, you've got a lot planned for here in Park City. If people are curious, where can they find out about the other ones before we go into what we have here?
They can go to the utahhumanities.org website to just get the full effect of what the, well, I mean, a lot of it's over. I mean, it's been going through the month of October, right. But they can still see what's coming up. Primarily, it's us next week.
All right. So this is the place next week.
This is the place.
You got a lot going on. Let's go through some of the, well, first of all, tell me about how you approached the thing philosophically. What were you trying to do with this festival?
Well, truly, thank you for asking that, because we have been wanting to do a book festival in Park City for a long time. It is a very literary community. I don't think people realize we are very highly educated. People love books and reading. And why not celebrate that at the Park City Library? So this was a great event and an opportunity to really bring that out in our community.
What I really like about it, and we're going to get into this, is the range of activities that you guys have planned for the across ages, across types, across genres. So let's start with what do we got coming up on Monday?
On Monday, we have got Michael Finkel coming to talk about his book, The Art Thief, in the Santee Auditorium at 6 p.m. Michael Finkel is a local, and we're excited to get to hear from him about his New York Times bestseller book.
So tell us a little bit about that book, because as I understand it, you know, he spent a long time trying to figure this out.
He did. His book is The Art Thief, which I said, the true story of love, crime, and dangerous obsession, in which he describes the strange and fascinating world of master thief Stefan Breitweiser, who stole art from museums and cathedrals all over Europe, not for money, but for passion.
Kind of sounds like a Daniel Silva novel come to life.
Yeah,
right?
It really does.
Okay, so that's Monday. What do we got coming up on Friday?
On Friday, we have Mystery in the Stacks, and I hope everyone will get involved with this. We are closing the library. We are doing a whodunit interactive theater event that night. You can get tickets. These tickets benefit the Friends of the Park City Library. So if you get involved, you will be doing something good for the library and having a fun evening. Park City Improv is acting out the scenes.
I was going to ask you who was doing it.
Yeah.
Park City Improv. Okay, so they're going to be, obviously it's participatory. You'll be able to interact with the actors. Okay, and how much are the tickets for that?
Those are $25 if you are a Friends of the Library member and $35 if you are a community member.
And what does it cost to become a Friend of the Library?
To become a Friend of the Library, we have different entry points, so you can choose whether you want to be a certain level member. You can go to their website and get your membership now in advance of buying the tickets.
Okay, so that's at 6 o'clock on Friday.
Yeah, 6 o'clock.
You ever done anything like that before?
We have not. This will be the first time.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. It'll happen all over the library, I take it.
Yeah, we'll
throughout
the library. Yep, we'll be wandering through the stacks trying to figure out who done it.
So, after an evening at the library Friday night, why should I come back on Saturday morning?
Saturday morning, you should come back for Favorite Lines and Pies. Roger, I don't know about you, but when I read, sometimes I read a line and I'm just like, whoa, that was so beautiful. I close the book and I'm just stunned. We are giving everybody the chance to step up to the mic and read a line from their favorite book. In addition, we'll have free pie that morning, and you can support Lucky Ones Coffee by buying a cup of coffee to go with your favorite lines and pies.
All right, Adrian, I'm going to put you on the spot. Yeah. What is your favorite first line from a novel?
Roger, I'm not awake enough to know my favorite first line from a novel, but if you come that morning, you will get to hear my favorite first line from a novel. So.
Okay, that seems like a reasonable start. I will tell you my favorite first line from a novel was a novel by Pat Conroy. And he was talking about his life. And the line was, I was born to be a point guard, just not a very good one.
That's a great
anyway.
One.
Anyway.
That's a great one.
Okay, what else have we got Saturday?
Saturday is an extravaganza of activity going on throughout the library. We have puppet shows for the kids. We have a book craft extravaganza. We have all the local authors from Park City coming in to set up tables where you can go in and talk to them, meet them, greet them, get to know who they are and see previews from their upcoming works as well as talk to them about their works that they already have. There are two opportunities, Roger, that I really want to emphasize during this festival. We have two departments from the University of Utah Marriott Library coming. We have the Book Arts Program. And for 4 hours that morning, you can see incredible, unique books that are works of art, handwritten, hand-printed. They're gorgeous. Don't miss that opportunity. In addition, we have rare books coming from the University of Utah, cuneiform tablets, Shakespeare portfolio pages. If you haven't seen some of these rare literary artifacts, you have 4 hours on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. to see those, and I wouldn't miss it.
And where are they going to set that up?
The rare books will be upstairs in room 301, and the art books will be on the second floor in room 201.
Okay, and there's going to be a number of local, I think you also mentioned there'll be a number of local authors. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we have amazing writers in Park City. We wanted to give them a chance to be a part of the book festival. So just come on out. You'll get to meet everybody who's writing. I think they'd love to meet you and get to know you.
Okay. I understand there's also going to be something for children that day.
For children, we have, of course, the puppet shows going on, and then crafts throughout the day. Hands-on, we have paper making, we have origami, we've got puppet making, bookmarks. Just come on out. There's something for everybody of all ages at this festival.
Okay. Saturday afternoon, we have Jack Carr.
Jack Carr. Nobody miss Jack Carr. If you don't know him, he is the writer of the Terminalist series that was adapted into a thrilling Amazon Prime Video series starring Chris Pratt. And he is now going to talk about his new nonfiction work called Targeted, Beirut, the 1983 Marine Barracks bombing, and the untold origin of the story of the war on terror. And he is also a local. He is going to answer questions, sign books. It'll be amazing to see him.
And, you know, he's somebody whose books sell incredibly large numbers, and is also, you know, frequently on television because he is, you know, sort of a pretty noteworthy author for us to have as a local.
He is, and okay. He's a podcaster.
He's a podcaster. Okay, so that's it for Saturday.
Yep.
Sunday, the Kids Dinosaur Stomp Party. What is that?
Yeah. So Sunday is kind of our kids' extravaganza starting at 1 o'clock. We have a Kids Dinosaur Stomp Party. Come out and sing and dance and roar like a dinosaur before our author. At that same time, while the kids are having fun with Miss Katrina in the community room, we have three renowned librarians coming up from the Salt Lake Valley to talk about 40 diverse books in 50 minutes. They'll give quick book talks on a number of books that get your kids interested in reading about people of all kinds.
Okay. And so that's Sunday. And then also, you mentioned Julia Lyon. Who is she and when will she be talking?
Julia Lyon will come right after the dinosaur stomp party. We're getting all the kids' wiggles out before they go in to talk to her about her book called A Dinosaur Called Ruth, a pioneer girl who found dinosaur bones in her own backyard.
Okay. Okay. So that sounds like a fairly impressive set of activities. What kind of attendance are you hoping for?
We're hoping for everybody to come out. This is what we want is an annual book festival. Mm-hmm. And I think that if everybody comes out and shows us that they love books, love reading, we can try and keep this going every year.
Is it expensive to put on something like this?
Well, we are so fortunate to partner with Utah Humanities because they actually pay the costs of our author speaker fees. So thank goodness for them. We are also partnering with Summit County and Wasatch County. They've got authors going at the Kimball Junction Library and also in Midway throughout the week. So check out the schedule.
I was gonna say, how can they find out about that? On their respective websites?
Yes, on their respective websites as well as Utah Humanities website.
And before we go, Adrian, recently I think you spoke at Rotary.
Yes, I
did. About banning books. Can you talk a little bit about that before we go?
Sure. So every year, the American Library Association has something called Banned Books Week. There is a trend where banning books is not new, but the uptick has gone up in the number of books that were banned. The library just brings awareness to this issue. Many of the books that are banned might have one word in it that someone doesn't like, and then all of a sudden it'll get challenged in a book or a library, a bookstore or a library. And so we just want to raise awareness about what's going on in this realm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else you want to touch on before we go?
Anybody who loves books, please come visit us at the Park City Library every Wednesday at 2 o'clock. I do my own book club, and it is for anyone who wants to come. It is called the Reader's Choice Book Club. You can come, tell us about what you've been reading, and hear what other people have been reading, so your reading list can grow and you get experience hearing about books of all kinds.
So do you also have a book that you share that every
week? I do.
Okay, so give us a couple of, before we go, just give us a couple of the titles of what you have coming up.
Well, it's whatever anybody's been reading.
Okay.
So it's to be determined each month. So come next November, the third Wednesday of the month, 2 o'clock. We won't do it in December, but we'll pick up again in January.
We've been talking to Adrian Herrick-Juarez about the upcoming book festival. Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back after this. Well, hundreds of firefighters from around the country are in Francis to fight the Yellow Lake Fire in the Uintas. As KPCW's Connor Thomas reports, they've been struck by the outpouring of community support.
Locals in the Camas Valley are showing their appreciation for the firefighters keeping the nearby blaze at bay in what Yellow Lake Fire Public Information Officer Jeff Armstrong calls an outpouring of community support. Residents spontaneously coordinated laundry and food service. He was one of the firefighters who got some clean clothes.
And ended up getting a text message, hey, it's dropped back off at base camp. There was a note from one of their little kids in there. You know, and I won't lie, it got me in the feels. It was kind of neat to see that level of support, and I haven't really seen that in a lot of communities.
Woodland resident Rachel Hatch says it all started when a firefighter asked the community if there was a laundromat around on Facebook. The usual Wildland mobile laundry service wasn't available at first.
After like a sleepless night thinking about it, our business is directly across the street from their base camp. And I was like, I'll just organize it. I don't have time to do all the laundry, but our location is just perfect.
So Frontier Woodworks has doubled as a dry cleaner of sorts. Hatch says at least 40 families have reached out to participate, and they've done more than 30 loads. She says that's fewer than she expected. More than 700 personnel were working on the fire as of Thursday. But not every fighter needs a fresh set, says Fire Information Officer Deanna Younger at a recent community meeting in Camas.
You might have seen some hot shots out at a gas station or somewhere. And even if they have laundry, they choose not to use it. So they have it available, but that's just the culture.
The nonprofit coffee shop Lucky Ones is another business firefighters are frequenting. Co-founder Taylor Matkins says they began accepting donations at both their Park City and Camas locations this week. Patrons can buy a firefighter a coffee, pastry, or a sandwich. There's a pinup board with vouchers that fire personnel can grab at the Camas location.
We've had a lot of interaction with customers coming in and paying it forward. So we're so grateful, and the community is really rallying around and trying to do whatever they can.
Before the rain and snow Thursday, the Yellow Lake Fire reached 33,000 acres at 30% containment. Now that the weather's on their side, fire crews are hauling some of their equipment out, Armstrong says. He's not calling it a season yet, but it may signal the beginning of the end of this wildfire. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
I also want to give you an update. The whole fire area got some snow last night, about 4 to 8 inches so far. The crews are waiting for a break in the storm to do more fire suppression, but it doesn't look like that's going to happen for a while, not until at least this afternoon. So precipitation is helping, obviously, the firefighters' efforts. More than 33,000 acres are involved in the fire, which at this point is 30% contained, although, again, they haven't been able to evaluate it after last night's snow. Unionized ski patrollers at Park City Mountain remain without a contract as opening day approaches. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has this.
The existing contract between the resort and the union, Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association, expired in April. The two parties have yet to reach an agreement and are still negotiating. During the union's last contract negotiations in winter of 2022, ski patrollers voted to authorize a strike. A walkout was averted after a deal was reached during their 50th bargaining session. According to union president Kate Lips, 90% of the over 200 ski patrollers at Park City Mountain and Canyons Village are dues-paying union members. Park City Mountain senior manager of communications Sarah Huey previously said the resort is committed to good faith bargaining and proud of the wages and benefits it provides. Union members have told KPCW they don't want to comment on the current negotiations until after their next bargaining session is complete. Both sides hope to have a new contract in place by the winter season. Park City Mountain is scheduled to open November 22nd, weather permitting. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Coming up Monday on Mountain Money, we've got a really interesting show. First, we're going to speak with Reed Galen. He is the co-founder of the Lincoln Project. But what we're going to be talking to him about is political advertising, the economics of it. How does it work? Who makes money? Those kinds of things. Then we're going to speak with Megan Gorman. She's got a new book out. It's called All the President's Money. And what it's about is the personal finances of American presidents. Some really interesting points there, some real surprises. Please tune in.